When the water is still, it is easy to have faith in the captain of your life vessel. But faith is a delicate thing. It has a tendency to escape right when we need it the most. When the storms of life surprise us and the water we thought would hold us up on the way to the other side is now slapping our boat around and threatening our lives, it can feel like Jesus is sleeping.
That's the Reverend Amos de Sasa, and today he brings you an inspiring message of faith entitled, The Water Will Hold You. I'm Peter Wallace, and this is Day One.
Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Now to introduce this week's preacher, here's our host, Peter Wallace.
Thanks, Sherry. We're delighted to welcome back to Day One the Reverend Amos de Sasa, co-pastor at Downtown Church, a new Presbyterian Church USA congregation in downtown Columbia, South Carolina, that he launched in 2011. The church was chartered in December of 2014. From 2006 to 2011, Amos was associate pastor of Eastminster Presbyterian Church, also in Columbia. He earned his bachelor's degree from Presbyterian College in Clinton, South Carolina, and his Master of Divinity from Wake Forest University. Amos, thanks for being with us again.
It's good to be here.
Last week, you shared with us how Downtown Church got started and what it's up to today and in the months ahead. You are co-pastor of the church now. How is the church clergy and leadership structured there?
Well, I've got a fantastic partner in ministry. Her name's Reverend Dawn Hyde. She just started in January with us, and she came all the way from California back home, I guess, to the South. Her family's from North Carolina and South Carolina. And so we do share leadership as co-pastors of the church. We co-moderate session meetings. We co-lead the staff. We're figuring it out. You know, we didn't have a lot of models to really imitate. And shared leadership is a unique thing in the church, which is actually seems ironic to mm-hmm. some extent. But yeah, we share leadership, learn from each other. We have different gifts, which is a good thing. And we tend to laugh at the same jokes, so which is also a good thing.
We keep hearing, and it's true, that increasing numbers of people are foregoing organized religion. You touched on this a little last week, but what would you say is working best these days to encourage people in the community there, and especially younger people, to engage in church?
What we're seeing at Downtown Church is not consistent with national trends. Hmm. We're seeing people come back to church. Now, it probably is a geographic tick. I mean, everybody, it seems, that is in Columbia, South Carolina, at least, grew up going to church. Mm-hmm. Most people did. So they have something in their background, something in their backstory that connects them to all the symbols and the rituals and the traditions and the story of the gospel. And for whatever reason, church no longer was relevant for them. It did not answer the questions they were asking. So I think that is probably one of the most essential things, is to figure out what are the questions people are asking, and to answer those questions instead of saying, well, you're asking the wrong question, you should be asking this one, because I'm a lot more comfortable answering that one. So at Downtown Church, we pride ourselves on not always succeeding. We fail very often. And what we do differently when we fail is we actually stop doing the thing that isn't working, which is—
What a concept.
Yeah. A lot of churches that I've encountered have a hard time stopping, even when it's patently obvious to everyone that this thing is not working, whatever program or idea, whatever legacy is, you know, being nurtured and maintained. And so if you know that you can stop, then you actually are more willing to try new things. But I think inertia sets in when you believe that this thing that you're creating or making or experimenting with is going to be stuck forever in the same spot. Mm-hmm. So it gets a little bit scary at that point.
And you are committed to the well-being of the people in your city and work with several outreach organizations, some of which you've founded, the Foot Care Ministry and Light the Way. Tell us about those ministry groups.
Yeah. You know, I think the church is uniquely positioned with access, not just to money, but also to networks. Mm-hmm. And what we've tried to do in Columbia, at least, is in the organizations that I've worked with, is to find places in which the church can actually make a difference, mm-hmm. And isn't duplicating, replicating something someone else is already doing. And again, you've got to know your context really well. Mm-hmm. You've got to know your community well. And, you know, we've been particularly interested not just in helping people, but also in forcing ourselves to encounter people that we otherwise would not. And so, you know, you call it whatever you want, missions or community service. But for us, it's just actually, I mean, following Jesus, really. That's all it mm-hmm. is. So it's not some appendage that's stuck onto the church's ministry. It really is just like trying to model the way that Jesus might live.
Hmm. You also serve on a number of boards, including some community boards, but you're also a trustee of Louisville Presbyterian Theological Seminary and serve on its presidential search committee. So much is changing in theological education these days. How do you think seminaries should be training clergy for the future? I would think more projects like Downtown Church would be relevant.
Yeah. Initially, when I was going through the ordination process, I had to take this psychological exam, and they graded me on this Myers-Briggs assessment. And apparently somebody has done some research that shows out of the 16 personality types that come with Myers-Briggs, they know which personality type you should be if you'd like to be successful as a pastor in mm-hmm. parish ministry. Well, this psychologist told me after my assessment that I was the 14th worst personality type, and encouraged me to stop now if I was smart. So I do think that we've got to begin to look for church leadership in places where we haven't looked before. So it's not just about training clergy once they get to seminary, but encouraging the right kind of people to go to seminary mm-hmm. in the first right. place. That might be the tougher nut to crack. Mm-hmm. And that might be where the future lies for people who are interested in theological education.
But you've turned out pretty well.
Yeah, but I was at dinner last night and with some people from our church, and this moment after we were done with dessert, and the guy goes, the reason I go to Downtown Church is because Amos, he's a lot like me. He didn't really like people that much. And I get that. And so, I don't think we have a church full of people that don't like people. And it's not that I actually don't like people. It's mm-hmm. just that I think there's a certain amount of myself that I try to maintain. And, you know, the pastor can oftentimes turn into a cliche itself. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So I try not to. That try to remain a person and not a stereotype.
Well, today your sermon draws from an account in Mark chapter 4 regarding Jesus' fearful disciples in a storm-tossed boat. Would you read the passage for us?
On that day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already being swamped. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased, and there was a dead calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?"
Amos, we look forward to learning more about this in your sermon today, "The Water Will Hold You." Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here. When the water is still, it is easy to have faith in the captain of your life vessel. When the sound of the sea returns dead calm and the winds are blowing somewhere else, you may even excuse the captain of your vessel to take a nap. Nothing is happening here. The skies are clear, the sailing will be smooth for this journey, so go to sleep, Captain. We got this. You need your rest. But faith is a delicate thing. It has a tendency to escape and go into hiding right when we need it the most. When your heart is tugging you towards an uncertain future, but where you are right now is cozy and comfortable. When the people who pay your bills expect something from you that your spirit isn't able to give. When your family is being ripped apart by the kind of quiet conflict that we are so good at hiding. When you lose a friend, maybe for a minute, while they explore new interests that don't align with yours. When you lose a friend, maybe for a lifetime. In moments like this, when the sounds of the sea rise from their slumber, with enough haste and violence to terrify experienced fishermen, and those of us that are just along for the ride, the fate that once gave us the confidence to send our captain to sleep can quickly disappear. In moments like this, the water, which once suspended us above the darkness lurking below the surface of the sea, now threatens to not hold us at all. We challenge ourselves to not let noisy distractions get in the way of God's voice. But what happens when the distraction appears to be an impending disaster, when the thunder rolls and lightning strikes? I had a moment like this in college. One of my best friends was a mess. His name was Paul, but he was also a man among boys. Paul wore his shirts tucked in, his pants were skinny long before it was fashionable, his hair did its own thing. He drove a Cutlass Supreme, a car specifically designed for retirees, but Paul drove it like he bought that car on purpose. If you asked him why he drove a Cutlass, he would lie and say it was used as a prop in a famous movie, and then you'd wish you were cool like Paul. Paul was charming like that. He played guitar. He had a classically trained voice. The girls thought he was cute and told him so. The boys silently regretted not keeping it as real as Paul. And he had a distinctive style that no one bothered imitating because none of us had the courage, like Paul, to love all the quirky, peculiar parts of ourselves that God made just right on purpose. From the beginning. But Paul wasn't perfect. He was also depressed. His depression was manic. He'd disappear for days and sometimes weeks. When he came back, he'd have a story to tell. But he left out the boring parts, where he stayed in bed, under the covers all day. Depression does that to you. It makes you want to hide from life. Eventually, he couldn't bear the pain of faking it anymore. If he couldn't live life with integrity, he decided that life wasn't worth living. He committed suicide when I was a sophomore in college. I thought Paul was fearless, that if a violent storm caught our crew out at sea, he'd probably sleep through it. But then he died. And for many months afterwards, I had a hard time believing that Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. I suspect I'm not alone. You too might have been there, in that place where faith feels like a relative term. It's easy to believe the water will hold you as long as the storms beat on someone else's boat. But when they come up on mine, I'm capable of asking all the wrong questions, just like the disciples in our story today. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Whose idea was it to go sailing today? It definitely wasn't mine. I don't even like sailing, and I was content right where we were, back there on dry land. And who hired this captain anyway? Was it you, Peter? Or you, James? Did someone check his references? 'Cause I can't imagine his previous customers would put up with a captain that can't stay awake.
I should be honest with you. I try my best to avoid activities that involve boats or water in the first place. I've gone offshore fishing before, but I'm not going again. I've attempted to water ski on a couple of occasions, but it was not pretty. I've done some laps in a pool to train for a few triathlons, but it was miserable. On one memorable occasion, I ignored my instincts and went on a boat ride with six friends in search of an island near Edisto, down on the South Carolina coast. The leader of our voyage said that there were monkeys on this island, and we were all curious. Well, we never saw the monkeys, because we got lost on the tiny boat for 6 hours. The captain of our boat that day said he knew where he was going, but he did not. He didn't know where to find the monkeys. It should have been a 30-minute round trip, but we never made it to the island, and we didn't know how to get home. We were lost, and then it got dark. So we just sat there, hungry, scared, pessimistic, and angry at the captain for getting us in this mess. He might as well have been sleeping. After a peaceful day of preaching to large crowds in his small inner circle of disciples, Jesus sets out in the evening for the other side of the sea, where we suppose he will do the same thing the next day. We aren't told which sea it was exactly, but we can assume that it was the Sea of Galilee. Throughout Mark's gospel, Jesus and his crew crisscrossed the sea, preaching, teaching, and performing miracles to people on either side. This trip doesn't appear to be any different than countless other trips this crew, which includes four experienced fishermen, will take. They set out in the evening, and it's not long before Jesus is passed out in the back, sleeping in the stern on a cushion. He has had a long day. Earlier in chapter 4, we're told that his work was being received well. The crowd that gathered to hear him was so big that he had to board a boat, wade out from the shore a little, drop anchor, and speak from the sea, because there wasn't enough space on land. If anyone's keeping score, it was a good day. His message is gaining traction, word is spreading, and now he needs to rest so he can do it again on the other side. And while he's asleep, the winds that carried their sailboat across the sea picked up force. Before long, the same winds gathered enough strength to unsettle the water. The boat that was gliding to the other side, as it had done many times before, was now being swamped by waves with no regard for the traveler's plans, schedule, or sense of direction. They never saw the storm coming. It surprised them and sent them running, running to Jesus, who was still asleep in the stern, at the back of the boat. They jolt him out of his peaceful slumber to ask him if he cares that they are about to die. The boat is sinking, and Jesus is sleeping. But it doesn't take long for him to respond to their question. In an instant, he speaks to the wind and rebukes the sea with the same command he used on a demon in Mark chapter 1. "Peace, be still," he says. And the wind stops and the sea returns to its natural state. The chaotic waters are now still. When the storms of life surprise us and the water we thought would hold us up on the way to the other side is now slapping our boat around and threatening our lives, it can feel like Jesus is sleeping. There were at least four fishermen on this trip, but none of them knows what to do. Some storms are so big that our technical knowledge is no match. We might know what we ought to do, but the chaos that surrounds us makes a mess of our minds. We can't think our way out of them because they're controlled by forces that elude our ability to reason. They escape our creativity. They ignore our determination to work harder. Some storms can't be calmed without Jesus. I won't dare to guess about why these storms come and who controls them. I don't know. These were good people trying to get across to the other side so they could share the gospel of Jesus with people that needed to hear it. That sounds like a good reason for God to protect them. They're just following Jesus, like they're supposed to, and he leads them right into a storm that seems deadly enough to threaten their lives. I don't know why the water turns against us sometimes, and I don't think the text cares. Ask Jesus why, and you might put him back to sleep. But it is worth our time to wonder why Jesus gets in the boat with us. And if we pause here, where God determined to step into our small, fragile, exposed boats and glide into the center of our storms, there is something for us to learn. You see, the more pressing question isn't why the storms keep coming. It's why Jesus keeps bothering to get in the boat. If you are in a storm where your boat's getting thrown around and it feels like the water won't hold you, look around. Someone is in the boat with you. If you're unemployed and your vocational vessel is getting rocked by the tumultuous waves of this economy that you didn't see coming, look around. Someone is in the boat with you. If the partner you've been sailing with for a long time has left for another boat or another sea, look around. Someone is in the boat with you. If it feels like your life vessel is drifting off course and the compass you've relied on sent you in the wrong direction, look around. Someone is in the boat with you. If you're in a stormy relationship and tempted to throw somebody overboard or at least drop them off at the nearest port, look around. Someone will be in the boat with you. If you've been trying to navigate the waters of life on your own but keep running into the persistent storm of your own sin and now you are lost, look around. Someone is in the boat with you. It may look like he's asleep, but don't be afraid to wake him up. He has the power to subdue chaos that is out of your control, and the power to tame the water so they can once again hold you. Jesus knows the storms are coming, but he keeps getting in our boat. Up to this point in our conversation, I have ignored an important part of this story. Did you notice that Jesus rebuked the disciples for their lack of faith about as quick as he rebuked the sea? Immediately after he calmed the waters, Jesus asked the disciples why they were afraid. It sounds like he's growing a little impatient with the disciples. He's sleeping and they are anxious and afraid. He's sleeping and they are confused that Jesus isn't as worried as they are. Jesus is fired up. But I think a close reading of the scripture will reveal that his frustration wasn't due to their lack of faith. I'm not sure he expected them to make it through the storm alone. There's nothing faithful about suffering alone or refusing to ask for help. But read closely and you'll see that the disciples never asked for help. They woke him up so he would worry with them. "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" they ask. The boat is sinking and Jesus is sleeping, so they tap him on the head and shake him, and when he finally wakes up, they say, "Hey, Jesus, wake up. Can't you see how bad things are?" Even if they believed that Jesus could do something about the sorry state of things, they never asked. They'd surrendered to their suffering, and the only thing worse than suffering through a storm is suffering alone. What about you? Have the storms of life ever been so bad that you just wanted someone to know? The chaos of life has unsettled the waters that once held you and you are sinking, but all around you, people sleepwalk right past your troubles. They don't notice your tears or your lack of laughter or the way you avoid looking people in the eye. They don't hear your prayers that come in the form of subtle hints you drop in everyday conversations. They don't see the trouble you're in. Or even worse, it feels like God doesn't notice that your ship is sinking. It feels like God went to sleep on you. The disciples scamper back to the stern to wake him up because They don't believe that he's paying attention. Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? The water won't hold us and you are asleep. Wake up and worry with us. But Jesus didn't get in the boat to worry. And he didn't get in the boat to die. The water will hold you because it's going to hold him. Why wouldn't the word that spoke the still waters into existence be able to still the stormy waters into submission? The water will hold you. The storms will come and threaten your life. The noisy distraction of worry is keeping you up all night, but Jesus is resting easy. The water will hold you. Jesus got in the boat with you, knowing there was a storm ahead. And the word that became flesh is not worried. The storms know what to do when he says, "Peace, be still." The water will hold you. Amen.
The Reverend Amos DeSasa was our preacher today. Amos is co-pastor of Downtown Church, a new Presbyterian church in Columbia, South Carolina. For a free transcript of his message, "The Water Will Hold You," call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1. That's 888-411-3291. Or write to us at Day 1, 2715 Peachtree Road, Atlanta, Georgia 30305. Please keep in mind that Day One depends on the financial offerings of our faithful listeners. We're grateful for your support. I'm Sherry Miller. Next time on Day One, we're delighted to have with us the Reverend Dr. Fairfax F. Fair, Senior Pastor of First Presbyterian Church of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Her sermon is entitled, "Choosing to be Captive or Free." You won't want to miss it. Now, Amos DeSasa offers some final reflections on his sermon today with our host, Peter Wallace.
Amos, like the disciples in their storm-tossed boat, we often experience moments in life when the thunder rolls and the lightning strikes and a pervasive fear that God forgot about us can strike us suddenly without warning. Why is it so easy to assume that God has forgotten about us if we have any faith at all?
There are moments in life when things get so bad, and not just God, but everybody seems so far off. Mm-hmm. And I don't blame people for feeling as if God forgot about them. Mm. And I do think that that might be the other side of the coin. It's hard to experience God without knowing the absence of God. Mm-hmm.
You noted that there were at least four fishermen on this boat, but none of them seemed to know what to do when the storm hits, and some storms just can't be calmed without Jesus, you said. And I'm wondering if we get so used to handling our own little cloudbursts in life by ourselves that we forget to call on Jesus when bigger storms strike. What do you think?
I think so. I have found myself, as I've grown up in age, relying on God for smaller and smaller things. My prayers have gotten smaller. And they're more specific to moments in time. And that's something that you would think would come from a child as opposed to like a grown adult. But yeah, my prayers have gotten really small, which means they've also gotten more frequent. And that's a good thing.
But you realize you do need God in every...
In Yes. I'm a bumbling mess, you know, most days. Like I said earlier, I ran way past this studio in my car before figuring out that I had passed it, even though I've got GPS and all those things. And so, you know, a simple prayer just to say, Lord, not just help me get there safely, but help me find this place mm-hmm. is an acknowledgement mm-hmm. that, you know, is God really going to help us find the place? Maybe not. But what does it do to me to yeah. say that all of my needs can be attended to by God, mm. that without God, I'm going to go flying past a lot of stuff?
You told us that the more pressing question isn't why the storms keep coming. That's just life. It's why Jesus keeps bothering to get in the boat with us. Because no matter what happens in our lives, someone is in the boat with us. He may look like he's asleep, but don't be afraid to wake him up, you told us. How do we do that? How do we keep this reality in mind that Jesus is with us?
Well, I think we have to be compassionate towards ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's a very hard thing to do in this world where we're constantly being told to be working on ourselves. And being reminded of what's wrong with us, you know, you're not productive enough, you don't sleep enough, you don't eat the right kinds of foods, you eat too much food, you know, on and on and on. And so we're constantly, we are projects, you know, ourselves, and we're trying to improve upon them. And I have found it to be liberating as of late to just say, I kind of like myself the way I am. Mm-hmm. Sure, there's some things that can change, and looking forward to experiencing the kind of transformation that's going to make me a better father and husband and pastor. But I need to be kind to myself. And in doing so, I think you can say, you can be okay with the imperfections, the moments in life where it does appear that God is absent. You can sit in that for a little bit longer. And you might even believe that, like, you're good enough for Jesus to show up right there with you. But if you don't like yourself, why would you think Jesus would be there with you?
Amos, what's one thing from your sermon that you hope our listeners will keep in mind in the days ahead?
Don't forget to wake Jesus up.
Amos DeSasa, thank you for being with us.
It's good to be here.
Day One is the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. Visit us online at dayone.org. Our program is recorded and edited by Donald Jones and produced by Peter Wallace. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sherry Miller, wishing you all God's blessings on day one and forever.